Toxic waste this morning is my subject. And the word toxic can encompass many things. Toxic, by the way, I know that's not the symbol for toxic. It's the symbol for radiation. I just didn't want to stand in front of a skull and crossbones and share, so I thought that would be better. It can mean poisonous. It can mean unpleasant. It can mean unhealthy. Toxic is something that should not be in a body. Be that the physical body, be that the spiritual body, be that the church. Something that's toxic is something that needs to be dealt with, or it will infect and poison more and more. Toxic things need to be removed from our lives. And I am sure there's many toxins we could be talking about this morning. And maybe we'll come back to them. But this morning I'm going to be talking about one in particular, but two toxic things that I believe are extremely destructive in the life of a church and extremely destructive in our own personal walks with God. Now, some of you might have been wondering the last couple of weeks why I, as the senior minister of the church, haven't spoke yet this year. That I didn't start the year off with the first message of the year like I usually like to do. And the reason is that when God gave me this message last year, I thought, I can't start the year with that. I don't want to start the year with that. Because I'll tell you this morning, this may be tough going. But I really believe it's important. And right through the end of last year, I just could not get away from this message. This message may offend or upset some of you. If that's the case, I don't apologize, because if you get offended, it means you need to hear it. And take comfort that this isn't coming from me, but this is from the words of Jesus. You know, this world has laws. It's got a lot of laws. And when you break a law, there's a consequence for that. We have national laws. For example, there is a law in this country that if you drive over the speed limit, you get fined. You get points on your license, or you get sent on a speed awareness course. You violate the standard, there's a price you pay. We have natural laws, like gravity. You know, gravity does not care if you believe in it or not. Its law still applies to you. You can think that you're an exception to the law of gravity, but if you step off a building, you will find out very quickly that you are not. It's a law. It's absolute. And if you violate it, there's a steep price. And there are spiritual laws. If we choose to ignore them or not believe them, it doesn't matter. They still exist. And the result is, when we break them, there's a price to pay. And here's a truth. One of the biggest barriers in the lives of Christians is an unwillingness to forgive other people the wrong that has been done to you. Unforgiveness is one of the most toxic things that there can ever be in the life of a Christian. You know, forgiveness can be hard, especially when you've been greatly wronged. In fact, often the greater the wrong, the harder it can be to forgive. And the more unforgiveness will therefore hold you back. So since forgiveness is so hard, sometimes we get this tendency to put in our minds, God will be okay with this. We understand Jesus taught forgiveness, but we think, but in this case, in my case, God gets it because he knows what I've been through. Because he knows how much this person hurt me. We think, I understand the rule, but God can make exceptions to it, and this is an exception. But the reality is, when you refuse to forgive people, you are holding back your spiritual development. And let me tell you, God is not okay with it. Not one little bit. There is a spiritual law. Forgiven people forgive. Notice I didn't say forgiven people should forgive, but rather forgiven people forgive. It is a natural response of the grace we've received. It's not a question of should. It's a fact that we do. This is not my opinion. This is biblical truth. Jesus had a lot to say about forgiveness. Most of us know the Lord's Prayer, I assume, extremely well. But I wonder how familiar we are with what happens after the Lord's Prayer. Let's just read the Lord's Prayer. Matthew 6, verses 9 to 15. It will be on behind me. Prayer like this. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we have also forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Amen. Of course, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever, is an addition, but it's a good addition. And then if we move now to verse 14... don't get ahead of me. If you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. Did you hear that? I'm going to read that again. It's amazing, you know, this is directly after the Lord's Prayer. I mean, you can't read the Lord's Prayer without reading this. If you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. That is an extremely intense sentence. That is a big sentence. What does Jesus mean? Well, he means what he said. Just as he always does. He tells us that for those unwilling to forgive, well, a price comes with that unforgiveness. Now, you can initially read that as a works-based thing. If you don't live up to this, then God won't forgive you. But it's not a works-based thing. What Jesus is saying is that it is impossible for someone who has been set free and forgiven their sin, for someone who is a follower of Jesus, it is impossible for them to hold on to bitterness and anger and blame and unforgiveness, and for them not to experience a certain amount or a huge amount of discomfort when they do that. I tell you, if you are a follower of Jesus, it runs against everything you stand for to hold on to stuff. So you will find yourself, if you've got unforgiveness, where it bears down hard on you. As a follower of Christ and reading that prayer whilst having something against someone, dear me, how can you do it? How can you pray, forgive me as we forgive others, if you've got unforgiveness in your heart? How can you take communion when you've not forgiven someone without it seriously convicting you? And if that's not the case, if there isn't this conviction, I tell you what, something's wrong. Forgive as we forgive others. In other words, we're asking God to forgive us with the same measure we are forgiven. Simon Mayo has on his radio show. Does anyone listen to Simon Mayo, or is it just me? There's a couple of hands there. That's okay. He has this show, a part of his show called Confessions. Now, in the 90s, when I was a teenager, I used to love listening to it on Radio 1. And now I'm old, I like listening to it on Radio 2. And I remember listening to Simon Mayo's Confessions when I was young. And for those unfamiliar with him, what happens is a listener writes in with a confession of something they did wrong. Usually a long time ago when they were at school, and usually a funny story. I don't know why so many funny stories of things we did wrong happened at school, but I guess that's maybe true for most of us. And then the team from Simon's radio show give judgment on whether the person who wrote in should be forgiven. They base it on how sorry the person sounds or how bad the thing was that they did. And they decide, between the three of them, so there's a consensus, if this person should be forgiven. That's very funny. But here's the problem. That's how many of us see forgiveness. We decide if someone deserves it. Should this person be forgiven? Are they sorry enough? How bad was the thing that they did? Do they seem repentant enough? And that shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the forgiveness we've received. See, we need to get this in our heads and our hearts. Forgiveness is not merit-based. Yours isn't. Mine isn't. Thank God my forgiveness is not merit-based. Therefore, we should give out with the same standard that we've received. They might not deserve your forgiveness, but that's okay because neither do you. Forgiven people forgive. End of story. No ifs and no buts. Now, you might respond to that and think, yeah, I get that. I get that. But you know what? Forgiveness shouldn't make me a mug. Shouldn't make me a doormat for people. But I'd say this, so what if it does? Matthew 5, verses 39 to 41, it says this. But I say to you, do not resist. Hey, I tell you what, there's a sentence. Do not resist the one who is evil. Tell you what, the governments of the world could learn a little bit more about this. Do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Now, I don't know about you. That sounds like a mug to me. That sounds like a doormat to me. So, you know what? Be a mug. Be a mug for Jesus. Went to see a film, Hacksaw Ridge, last night, about a guy who refused during World War II to carry a gun into battle. And his whole, what's the platoon? Whatever you call it, were against him. And one guy hits him in the face and says, aren't you supposed to turn the other cheek now? And this guy stands there and takes a beating. All to stand up for the fact that he will not harm another life. He doesn't want to take a life. Let me tell you, everybody around him thought he was a mug. But he proved himself to be the strongest and bravest amongst them. Be a mug, but be a mug for Jesus. This attitude of nobody's going to make a mug out of me, it's pride. It's what it is. And pride will keep you from forgiveness. Peter asks Jesus about forgiveness on one occasion, in Matthew 18, verse 21. And Peter came up to him and said, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as 7 times? Why did Peter ask this? Well, I wonder if Peter was struggling with forgiving somebody. I think as you read this question, there's this sense of frustration in the question. See, Peter's asking this on the back of something. Jesus is talking about how to handle it when a brother sins against you and how we sort it out. And Peter's question seems to be sparked by that teaching. And it sounds to me like when Jesus was teaching, he hit a sore point with Peter. And Peter goes, whoa, how many times am I expected to forgive? As many as 7? I got to say, if Peter struggled with forgiveness, I suspect we do. I can hear you thinking. Yeah, I get this. I get it. But you don't know how badly I've been hurt. I get how this works generally. But this, you don't know. This one is a serious issue. This damaged me. God would never ask me to forgive something so bad. But here's the challenge. Hard as it is to accept, yes, he would. It's interesting Peter chooses 7 times. Because, of course, you know, 7 is the number of completion. It's a perfect number. So when Jesus is, when Peter's asking Jesus about 7 times, it's like he's saying, should I completely forgive? Should my forgiveness be perfect? Should forgiveness be complete? And Jesus' answer must have been a surprise to Peter, because to say that, should my forgiveness be complete, you'd think, I'm putting this quite well. And Jesus says in Matthew 18:22, Jesus said to him, I do not say to you 7 times, but 70 times 7. Jesus said, no, not only do you completely forgive, but you constantly forgive. You continually forgive. Forgiveness is not a one-time choice. It is a daily decision. If you can forgive somebody for something today, but then you bring it up again tomorrow, guess what? You've not forgiven. If you bring something up that somebody's done against you after you've said you've forgiven them, you've not forgiven them. You know, Jesus said people would know we were his disciples by our love for one another. Sometimes I look at the church and I understand why people don't believe. Forgiveness is not optional. You know, as ministers, sometimes what we do is we try and soften the blow a little bit. We say, you know, you really should forgive, because unforgiveness, it's heavy, isn't it? It's a heavy weight to carry. The only person you're hurting is yourself. And that's true. But that's not why we forgive. We forgive because Jesus told us we have to. And not forgiving spreads bitterness amongst us. Hebrews 12, verses 14 and 15, it says, strive for peace with everyone, and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. See, bitterness doesn't just affect you. It spreads. It defiles other people. Let me tell you, we can't live like that. We can't. Martin Scorsese recently brought a film out about Jesuit priests. I don't know if anybody saw it. It was a hard film to watch. It's called Silence. And it's about Jesuit priests who go into Japan during a time of persecution to try and bring the gospel. It's a very difficult film to watch because some of the persecution that people went through in Japan because they believed in God was horrible. It's horrible. But there was one thing as I was watching this film that really struck me. They're helped by this Japanese man called Kirijo. This man was in exile because he denied the faith to save his family. But this father, called Rodriguez, trusts him to get him into the country. And time and again throughout the film, Kirijo betrays him to save his own skin. Time and again, he gets him into trouble because he's just too cowardly. And as a result, Father Rodriguez is placed in prison. He's tortured. Innocent people die as a result of this man's cowardice. And every time, Kirijo comes back and asks him for forgiveness. And every time, Rodriguez forgives him. He forgives him and treats him just like he would anybody else. And I was so struck watching it. I was sat there thinking, this guy does not deserve to be forgiven. Rodriguez was a mug. And he would only betray him again and again and again. But over the years, this man became one of his closest friends. Because every time he forgave him, he didn't hold anything against him. Every time he looked at this man, he looked at someone as if he never betrayed them. And I really felt God was saying to me as I was watching that, that's how you've been forgiven. That's how you should forgive. That's the forgiveness we should all show. To say, I've forgiven them, but I can't speak to them. I've forgiven them, but I can't be around them. I forgive them, but I don't trust them. You haven't really forgiven them. When we are forgiven by God, we can stand in front of God as if we never sinned. When we forgive others, they should be able to stand in front of us as if they never hurt us. See, that's the test of forgiveness. That's where you find out if your forgiveness is real. Can they stand in front of you as if they never hurt you? On January the 5th this year, just a few weeks ago, Jill Sarwood, died, age 51. You may have heard of her, you may not. Earlier in her life, she made the headlines. She was brutally and horribly raped by intruders into her father's vicarage. Three men broke in wearing balaclavas, high on drugs, and armed with knives. Public outrage erupted at the end of the Old Bailey trial 11 months later, when in a statement he would regret till the end of his life, the judge, a Mr. Justice Leonard, infamously adjudged that her trauma can't have been so great because she was dealing with it so well. He'd been taken in by how calm she was. And as a result, these guys were not given the sentence that they should have been given. When he retired in 1993, he publicly apologized to her. In 1998, Jill came face to face with a guy called Robert Horscroft, who was jailed for 14 years for burglary and assault, but was not involved in the rape. And she told him, "You don't need to say sorry." And he told Jill, he said to her, "I've no right to ask for your forgiveness." She held his hand and replied, "You have it anyway. You've had it for a very long time." When later in life somebody asked her about this, she said, "It's not a question of whether you can or can't forgive. It's a question of whether you will or you won't." Of course, sometimes I thought it might be quite nice to be full of hatred and revenge. But I think it creates a barrier, and you're the one who gets damaged in the end. So although it makes you vulnerable, forgiving is a release. I don't think I'd be here today without my Christian faith. And that's what got me through. She added in an interview with the Sunday Mirror in 1998, "If I'd carried on hating, it would have destroyed me." In her book, Rape, My Story, she wrote this: "I believe forgiveness gives you freedom. Freedom to move on without being held back by the past. Jesus has completely forgiven us. Not only that, he continually forgives us." You know, every day he's got to forgive you. Why would we expect that he demands less from us? Jesus responds to Peter's question about forgiveness with a story. We can find it in Matthew 18. I'm going to read verses 23 to 35. "Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle account with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, 'Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything.' And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. But when that same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, 'Pay what you owe.' So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, 'Have patience on me, and I will pay you.' He refused, and he went and put him into prison until he should pay the debt. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed. And they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. Then his master summoned him and said to him, "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should not have had the mercy on your, and should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you?" And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you who do not forgive your brother from your heart. Let's just take a moment. I'm just going to get another glass of water, sorry. Let's just take a moment and look at some of the currencies that we used here. Because we read two different currencies. We get given two different figures of money. We get given denarii and talents in the story. An average day's wage at the time for a common soldier or a labourer was one denarii. A quick scale of currency back then is we're looking at one denarii was a day's labour. A shekel was about 4 denarii. A mina was about 100 denarii. And a talent was about 6,000 denarii. 6,000. Around that, I tried a number of different conversion tools and I came between 5 and 8. So 6 seems safe. Let's just compare that and convert that into pounds for a second. Some big numbers coming. An average wage for a police officer today is apparently £20,000, which seems very low. I went with a police officer because a soldier on the street, police officer, seemed like a decent comparison to me. So per day, we're looking at around about £54 a day-ish. For an 8-hour day, I think that probably works out pretty much minimum wage. That's based on a 7-day week. If it was, I just can't work out what. This is the minimum it would be. £50 a day is not a lot of money, is it? So therefore, one talent is 6,000 of that. So one talent in pounds is around about £324,000 minimum. That's a lot of money. That's the cost of a big house around here, or a tiny little flat on the outskirts of London. The guy in this story owed 10,000 talents. That is a massive amount of money. The equivalent today is 3.2 billion. Not million, billion. That is an absolutely huge amount of money. Now, some people have more money than that. Can you believe that? There's people in this world who have more money than that. In fact, if you had 3.2 billion, you would not make it into the top 500 billionaires on the Forbes list. You wouldn't make it in the top 500. It's less money than Donald Trump has. It's less money than Bill Gates has. It's less than Mark Zuckerberg has. Or Rupert Murdoch. See, for us, that's an inconceivable amount of money. But it is the kind of money that some people do have. On an average day's wage, it would take you 1,600 years to pay it back. Can you imagine the response from the crowd listening to this? How on earth, this guy's saying, "Be patient with me and I'll pay it back." How is he going to do it? He can't do that. He would never be able to repay that amount of money back. That money is not coming. If I owed somebody 3.2 billion, I don't know where I'd get that from. But you know, that's just like our sin. Our sin is a debt we cannot afford to pay. And when this servant falls before the king and says, please be patient with me, it's a hollow promise. Please be patient with me while I try and find £3.2 billion. There is no way. And sometimes we come to God, God forgive me and I'll be good. Let me tell you, all the good we can do could never repay the bad we've done. He says to the king, be patient. How patient does that king want to be? That king can't wait 1,600 years. Just as we can be with our sin, this guy was delusional. No amount of good deeds will pay off our debts. We can't afford it. If somehow good deeds did cancel out bad deeds, which it doesn't, we'd still be stuck paying them off longer than we could ever manage. And then Jesus provided us with hope. He forgave the debt. Just like the king in the story forgave the debt, Jesus forgave our debt. All of it. Let me tell you, you are not partially forgiven. The whole debt is cancelled. After that, the servant went out and looked for somebody who owed him money. He didn't just stumble across this person. He went out and looked for him. And he threatened him for 100 denarii. Update that, you're looking about 5.5 grand. It's a fair amount. It's certainly not going to do much to pay off his debt. He was so unwilling to forgive. See, the king didn't put this man in prison. This man's attitude put him in prison. He was responsible for the prison he got thrown into, just as we are when we are unforgiving. We have been forgiven billions and billions of pounds, and we get angry and chase people down over the injustice and grievances in our lives worth pennies. Pennies. How often do we get so het up and angry with someone over something that's so tiny, and we build it into this big thing? Let me tell you, we've been forgiven billions. What right do we have to chase people around for pennies? Small things blown up like they're huge. Why? Because we think we have a right to be offended. I really believe one of the reasons we don't forgive is pride. Pride. And that's the other toxin we need to kick out of our system. If it's not I that lives, but Christ that lives in me, then people can't offend me. Because it's not I that lives. We cannot be people of pride if we want to live for God. Because pride says, I'm right, they're wrong. Pride says, I've got this one right, they're the one who's sinning. Pride says, if you hurt me, I don't get past it. Pride will mess you up. And don't forget, of course, pride is a sin. That means it's a big deal. Sometimes we just brush pride down as a character flaw. No, it's a sin. Pride brought down Satan. It's a sin that got him cast from heaven. And it's the sin that many Christians allow to bring their faith crashing down around them. If you can't forgive somebody because you're the one in the right, let me tell you, you need to check your pride. If everybody who disagrees with you is wrong, you need to check your pride. James 4 verse 6 says this, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. The New King James Version says of that, God resists the proud. Does it feel sometimes like God is resisting you? That what you're praying for just isn't getting that breakthrough? You need to look at the pride that you've got in your life. Prideful people will not have the blessing of God upon their endeavors. They won't. In fact, he will resist their endeavors. You feel like God's always coming up against you, you need to check your pride. Pride needs kicking out of the church, and it needs kicking out of our lives. And when it is, I tell you what, when pride is gone, there'll be a lot more forgiveness going on. Pride sees the error in others and ignores it in ourselves. Pride is just as toxic as unforgiveness. You know, this year, I've tried abandoning social media for a bit. Since the new year, not been on. I've gone on and put stuff for the church, but I've not gone on and read stuff. Facebook, Twitter, I've put the cast them aside for a while. And I'm doing quite well. I'm quite pleased. And I tell you what, it's like a load's been lifted. What a relief it is. See, I would get to the point where I'd go on and I'd look and all I'd see, pride, 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 pride. See, people don't post things on social media into a vacuum. They post because they want to see they want people to see what they've written. That's why you put something on there. You want somebody to read it. Now, I don't blame Facebook or Twitter for that, but let me tell you, they have become pride's playground. Bragging about your correct views, political or spiritual. Bragging over your achievements, or over your family, or over your church, or over your friends, or even over people you vaguely like. And if it's not that, we're feeding into other people's sense of pride. They take a picture of them going like this. And we post, oh, you look beautiful, you look amazing, you look wonderful. That top really goes well with you. I tell you what, it's like constantly being surrounded by people shouting, I'm great, I'm great. It's like reading the constant prayer of the prideful Pharisee. I'm great, look what I'm doing. I'm tithing my herbs and spices. It's a place where everybody's right, but nobody's righteous. You know, I'm not against social media, it can be a useful tool. But there's something about posting something just to get affirmation. I'm not saying don't post, I'm saying examine the motives as to why you are. Are you waiting for somebody to click that thumbs up? Are you waiting for somebody to tell you how good you look in that picture? Are you boasting? Oh, my family's amazing. My church is amazing. I'm amazing. Are you letting pride grow? Also, this is off topic, but I would seriously recommend taking social media fast. I tell you what, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It tells you the world, but anyway, that's just a recommendation. You can do this. This is just social media. You can take this offline. You can take this offline in your everyday. What's your conversation? Is your conversation always about you? Is it always about how amazing your friends are? Is it always about how amazing your family is? Is it always about how you're just trying to boost up this sense of pride? Getting all puffed up when we succeed, even when we're doing God's work. Thinking that you're doing more for God than anybody else. Or what you're doing for God's more important than what anybody else is doing. Thinking you're more spiritual than anybody else because you do A, B, and oh boy, do you do C. I even tithe my herbs and spices. Pride, pride, and more pride. It's rife within the nation, and it's rife within the church, and it's got to be put down like the rabid dog it is. Paul said this in Galatians 6:14, and Steve read this morning. Far be it from me to boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me, and I to the world. I will not boast in anything other than Christ. I will not, I must not, and I can't boast in anything other than Christ. Because he's all I've got to boast about. We've got to take ourselves off the pedestal. Because when we think we're better, when we are worth more than others, we won't forgive. Because we'll take grievances extremely personally. Incidentally, pride also says God's okay with my attitude because of all the good things I do for him. The prideful Pharisee noted he was a good tither. And he was a hard worker and a good prayer. Matthew 5, verse 23, it says this. If you are offering a gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. Let me tell you, if you think your hard work, your service, or your tithes are worth anything, if you have a prideful, unforgiving attitude, think again. Worth nothing. You think your hard work is worth that much? Let me tell you, it's worth nothing if you've got a sinful attitude. Christians forgive. End of story. Romans 12, verses 17 and 18 says this, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, as far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. There's a verse that goes against everything your brain tells you to do. As far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Even that person. Yeah. With all. That means whatever the other person does, we live peaceably and we forgive. What they do, that's on them. That's nothing to do with you. What you do, that's on you. Forgiveness is not a natural response, but it's God's way. I can't speak about this without having a brief stopover at Matthew 18, 15 to 20. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. If he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen to them, even to the church, let him to be you as a Gentile and tax collector. Truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again I say to you, if two of you agree on earth about anything they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among them. Oh, I need some more water, sorry. Thank you. It's three glasses. I don't think we can read this verse too many times. Because at the first sign of trouble, we forget this verse. We do. We know it. We know it. We know it. We know it. Trouble kicks off, we forget it. First, sort it out between you two alone. Second, that doesn't work. Take one or two others with you. Speak to them again. Third, if they refuse to listen, you take it to the church leadership in the church. Four, if he refuses to listen even then, let him to be you as a Gentile or tax collector. Why did Jesus tell us to do this? Well, first, it's the correct godly way to do it. It's the only way for true harmony and unity. Second, Jesus told us to do this because we need telling. Because if he hadn't told us to do this, we wouldn't do it. It would not occur to us on our own to handle things in this order. It's not the way we would choose to handle disputes. It's not the way we'd want to go. Because what we always want to do is skip to stage 3 and 4. Forget 1 and 2. 3 and 4, that's where we want to be. Jesus says when someone sins against you. By the way, he says sins. I think it's interesting. He doesn't say upsets. He doesn't say disagrees. He goes to the most extreme one. Sins. The one that's the most harmful, the one that's the most hurtful. Sins again. Not just someone's wrong, when someone sins against you. Why does he go for the most extreme one? I believe it's because there's no get-out clause when he says sins. Because sins includes everything up to that point. If he said upsets, we'd be justified in saying, well, this one's a sin. But when he says sins, we're not justified by anything beneath that. Does that make sense? We can't say what this person has done is too serious for me to take this method because Jesus said sins. So a little thing and the big thing are both included there. He says, go and tell them. Don't write. Don't text. Don't message them on Facebook or whatever other instant way you have of communication. No WhatsApp. Don't do that. Go to them and tell them. Now, I know they didn't have social media back then, but Jesus doesn't say, I think he says go for a reason. Because he could have wrote. No. Go. Step one is not tell the pastor or an associate pastor or a life group leader or a friend. In fact, once you've said it to a friend, it's becoming gossip, and that's another sin. I'm amazed by how many people skip step one and two the second they're upset and bring it straight to the church leadership. Listen, I'm here for you. I am. But I'm only going to advise two things. Step one and step two. That's all you're going to get from me. Because I really believe most issues will be sorted with step one. And then not, if not, then we're dealing with step two. If we get to step three, then it's a serious issue. But we should never skip to it. But so often we do. So many times. Incidentally, step four, treat them as a Gentile or tax collector, doesn't mean you treat them like they're the enemy. If you're going around treating the unsaved like they're the enemy, there's something wrong. How do we treat the tax collector and the Gentile as somebody who needs Jesus and needs restoration? They may reach a point where they're not considered part of the body, but you never consider somebody beyond restoration. A church should not be biting and griping and devouring each other. See, that's how the Galatian church ended up. And it's a signal that there's something deeply wrong. Pride. Unforgiveness. They need kicking out the back door. No. They need kicking out the front door so everyone can see them leave. We don't forgive because it sets us free. Although it does. We forgive because Jesus told us to. How can we earnestly say the Lord's Prayer when we've not forgiven? How can we not stumble over those lines? Jesus was clear. You must forgive. And if that's the case, if we are not forgiving, we are not forgiven. Then in that case, unforgiveness is absolutely unacceptable behavior in the life of a Christian. Unacceptable. And it's got to stop. I really felt God say to me, if there's no unity, God's not going to bless it. Have you really honestly forgiven those who've sinned against you? If you said yes in your head too fast, then maybe there's somebody you're trying to avoid thinking of. Have you really honestly forgiven everyone who sinned against you? Have you let pride take root in your life? Do you exalt yourself above other people? If you said no too fast, then maybe there's some area you're not trying to think of. These two things are the most toxic things you can have in your life. The most toxic things you can have in your church. And they're causing us to waste our energy and our lives on bitterness and upset. And it is a waste. They've got to go. They've got to be crucified. You know, the old man is no excuse for unforgiveness. You can't get away with saying, it's just the way I am. No, it's sin. Forgiveness is paramount to your lives as forgiven people. That is a spiritual law. And when we live outside of it, we imprison ourselves and we damage ourselves. You are not an exception to that. You might think you're an exception to that, but you're not. If you need to sort something out, don't delay. Sort it. You need a detox. You need that toxin gone. Who do we forgive? Everyone. What do we forgive? Everything. How often do we do it? All the time. This isn't advice. I'm not saying you should. I'm saying you have to. You absolutely have to. But I can't. No. You have to. But I don't want to. You still have to. It's hard. Yeah. Even so, you have to.